Good morning. My name's Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. And because of the grace of God, the fellowship and steps of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. And that amazes me every time I say it. I want to thank Dave and the committee for inviting me. It's always an honor to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really exciting to do Sunday morning because I get the last word, which is my favorite thing. And also, you know, one of the new exciting twists of Alcoholics Anonymous is that, it's Sunday morning, the day after Saturday night. I woke up in a strange city in a strange bed, and I know where I am and how I got here. So you get all kinds of pluses they don't tell you about when you're new. How many people were at their first convention ever? That's great. I love conventions. I went to conventions early on. I don't really know why. There was one coming to town, so I went. But, you know, what I know now is that there's such an energy here because you are surrounded by people who want to be here. You know, you are surrounded by people who have enthusiasm. And if that's my husband, I will call him back. Surrounded by people who want to be here. And, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that wasn't always my story. How many people were in their first 90 days? Wow, all old-timers here. I'm going to have to give a different talk. Well, the bottom line is I did not walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous say, thank God I'm home. I want what you have. This was the end of the line for me. This was no other options. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to AA meetings in the 60s because my dad got sober when I was 7 years old. And Friday nights they would go to an open meeting at the next town over because we lived in a smaller town. I grew up in Oxford, Ohio, where that's Miami of Ohio. And, although we think they should be Miami of Florida, we were there first. But anyway, I grew up in a small college town, and so we would go to Hamilton, Ohio on Friday night for the open speaker meeting, and I was the kid back in the corner with the coloring book and the crayons, coloring my way through the meeting. And so, you know, I knew that AA was all old people. They smoked a lot. They drank coffee. They had donuts. That was a plus. But, I'm sure these ancient folks were my parents' age, you know, which is near dead when you're seven. they're 30, 40 years old. And so my dad didn't drink through my childhood. I did not have active alcoholism in the house. My parents didn't fight a lot. My mom was a cupboard door slammer. That was about as violent as it got at our house. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous meant don't drink, that you don't have to drink. My dad told me about the tragedies of his drinking and all the lost opportunity. And I have to say, when I started to drink, I felt really bad for him that he had such a hard time of it. I would have quit too if I was him. But long before I drank, I didn't drink till I was 15 years old. And I had this thinking going on. Now, I would not have told you I was a big thinker. Even new in sobriety, I wouldn't have told you I was a big thinker. But looking back now, my thinking was off from the beginning. I had all these rules that I lived by that my parents never taught me, never, ever, ever, ever tell anyone if you have made a mistake. Do not admit that you're wrong. Just go down with the ship, And the other one was that it's not all right not to know. Whatever it was, I couldn't tell you that I don't know how to do that. I couldn't tell you that I don't know what you're talking about. In school, I would get embarrassed for the kids who raised their hands and asked questions because I would think, oh, Jesus, now everybody knows you don't know. So consequently, I couldn't, if I wasn't good at something by the second or third time I did it, why bother? If you can't win, why play? And so there were a lot of things I never did and a lot of things I never tried because I was just afraid of looking bad. At 6 years old, I didn't want to look bad. And I don't know where that came from, but it was like breathing to me. My life was a spectator sport, and I was the one watching. I was acutely aware of all of you watching me. And how does it look to you if I'm talking to you? And, I was obsessed with, and the big book says that when we do the inventory, we start to see that the world and its people dominated us. And I didn't really get that when I was new, because I drank with motorcycle clubs. I had my own Harley Davidson. People didn't push me around much, you know. And I thought that dominated meant being pushed around. And, you know, what I know now, even looking back at first and second grade, is what dominated me was your perception of me. What do I have to do so you'll see me? You know, it's like I spent my life trying to arrange your perception of me so that I could live comfortably. And I don't know where that came from. But, you know, I didn't connect the dots. Like, you know, people would be good at the piano and I wasn't. And I didn't reason through the fact that the ones who were good at the piano were the ones who couldn't come out and play because they had piano lessons, or they couldn't come out and play because they had to practice. You know, I just thought, how nice for you that you can play the piano. I guess I'm just not gifted. You know, I didn't get that whole set the goal, work for the goal, achieve the goal thing. That, you know, my outlook on life has always been more like, just give me the goal, you know. You should just give it to me. And there's a story I always tell about my daughter, because this is when I started to see how off my thinking was long before I drank. When I got sober, my children were 4 and 6 years old. I have a son and a daughter, and they were not in my custody at the time. But you know, my four-year-old, we would have told you she was the one that was going to end up here. We were convinced. I mean, she just had that gleam in her eye, and, you know, and we would tell people, you know, most people save for college, we're saving for treatment. Because we knew. And so when she was 11, she wanted to be on a swim team, and she hadn't had much experience in the water. We got her a few lessons, and she went and tried out for the team that her friends were on. And the coach said, well, you could be on the team, but you really should practice with the age group below you, because you can't keep up with your age group yet. Now, if they had said that to me at 11 years old, I would have left. You know, I'm sorry, I'm 11. How's that going to look if I swim with the 9-year-olds? You know, that was okay with her for some reason, so she practiced with the lower age group. She went to her first swim meet. It was a huge USS meet where they run heat after heat and then put your results up with your whole name so anybody walking by can see how you did. And she was 70th out of 72, and she went back the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to relocate. And we told her, you know, swimming's a competitive sport, Sarah, but now that you have this baseline time in your next race, even if you don't win, if you beat your time, you've had a successful race. And the whole time I'm telling her this, I'm thinking, yeah, right, you know? I mean, this is not real. This is what you have to tell your children to build their self-esteem. Nobody buys into this. And, you know, I mean, my parents told me that, and I never believed it. It was all about winning, you know. She beat her time, and she was happy. Now, you know, the rest of that story is that 2 years later, she was a state AA swimmer, you know, swimming in the Junior Olympics at Keating Natatorium in Cincinnati. And I would have missed every bit of that on day one when they said practice with the 9-year-olds, because I wouldn't have wanted to look bad. So I, you know, I just remember having this. Now, I have to tell you, I was 7 years sober when she was 11 and practicing with the 9-year-olds, and I was having a hard time just being the mom of the kids swimming down an age group. Because, you know, how's that going to make me look, you know? Pinnacle of mental health up here. But, you know, I saw that, and so I started to suspect maybe this is what normal thinking looks like. I don't know. I've certainly never seen it. But I could see we were so clearly different at age 11, and neither one of us had ever had a drink at age 11. And, you know, she went on into high school and just did normal stuff, you know, and her junior year, Starbucks opened in our town, and she came home and said, we went to Starbucks with them, you know, after school. And I said, oh, that's great. Who'd you go with? And she said, Lindsay, Katie, and Jennifer. And I said, her? And she looked up and said, oh, for God's sakes, Mom, that was sixth grade. Could you let it go? At that point, Chuck and I looked at her and said, you know, there's supposed to be one mature person in the house. Congratulations, we think it's you. So I didn't think right long before I drank. I mean, that's the point. That's why I always tell that story, because somewhere she did internalize, set the goal, work for the goal, achieve the goal. She knew what she wanted to do before she got out of high school. She had always been intrigued by the military. She talked to the recruiter. She signed with the Army after her junior year in high school and went in through the delayed entry program and a couple pay grades up. And she is currently at Fort Hood, Texas, with her third year with the Army. She knows what she wants to do. And that just amazes me, because I've always just kind of bounced around like the pinball, Now, I land on my feet a lot, which made my mom crazy, because I would have consequences, maybe. Never what they should have been. I started to drink at the end of my freshman year in high school, and things changed immediately. Within a year, my friends all changed, my appearance changed, my grades plunged. I had totaled a car with three other people in it. Everything about me changed. You could just check your way down that checklist of, is your child doing this? I was a poster child for adolescent treatment, but they didn't really have adolescent treatment in the early 70s, at least not where we live. So I just kind of slid on through. But from the very first time I drank, some of the people I knew were starting to drink, and they were falling down and throwing up and looking bad. I didn't want to do that, certainly. So I just kind of got a glow on the first time I drank. And I, I don't remember that I knew my life changed at that moment. Although to this day, I could tell you, when it was, what I was wearing, who else was there. It was a turning point, to be sure. And I took my best friend out the next day and got her drunk so I'd have somebody to drink with. And that friendship didn't last another year, because we did not drink the same. We did not drink the same. Alcoholism took over my life the second I put it into active play, And for the next 14 years, it took things away. I gave things away. And things went away that I didn't even know were missing. I didn't even see them go by the wayside. I was super active up until I drank, a cheerleader, student council, you name it, I did it. And I know now a lot of that's because I couldn't stand to be alone. I couldn't stand to just be Beth. I didn't know what to say after my name's Beth. It never seemed like enough unless I was Beth the cheerleader, Beth student council member, Beth Jim and Sally's daughter. I didn't know how to talk to people. What do you say after, hi, my name's Beth? And she'll say, hi, my name's Nancy, and then, pretty sure it's my turn to talk. And then all the voices in my head start, well, say something. You're just staring at her. Well, don't talk now. You'll look dumber if you talk than if you don't, And they're up here fighting. I'm standing there speechless staring at Nancy, and I finally just say, nice to meet you, and run for the hills, Because I don't know what to say, I didn't have a conversation with anybody until I was 6 months sober. I mean, I talked with people, but at 6 months sober, I realized that I was just talking to somebody. They said something, I said something, they said something, I said something. And it was so amazing that it didn't take a vote by committee up here to pick the next response. That was new for me, because I just couldn't do it. And I would not have told you I was self-centered. The first couple times I came through AA and they talked about being self-centered, I thought that was selfish and vain, which certainly didn't apply to me. And, I didn't understand that self-centeredness was just exactly what I described. I don't want to do it if it's going to make me look bad. I think all of you are watching me all the time. What are you going to think? What do I have to do to make you like me? I didn't know. I thought I was just an independent free spirit. And one of the distressing things that my inventory turned up was the whole time I was out there being a free spirit, I was searching for somebody to take care of me, because I just couldn't do it. It was too hard. But anyways, I muddled through high school somehow. I went off to college. Because that's, I grew up in a college town. I thought that's what was expected. I flunked out the first semester. I had a 0.8. And because I couldn't go to class. Because I couldn't, what do you say? Now, I was a 17-year-old freshman in the middle of a 21 state. That didn't help. Sometimes I think if I could have drank more, I could have made it. You know what I mean? But I had to do a lot of college sober. And I couldn't, what do you say when you go to class and you're sitting next to somebody and you say, hi, my name's Beth, and hi, my name's John, and how do you think the teacher's going to be? You know, I mean, I just couldn't do it. And so I quit going. It was just, it was too hard. Now, again, I would not have told you that I was afraid of much, you know. I had fear down the side of my inventory because the big book had fear. And I figured if there was that much there, I probably had some. I'll just write it down and maybe it'll turn up later, you know. But I didn't know I was afraid of everything. So anyways, I you know, flunked out of school. I came back to Oxford. I got a job in a bank because I thought that was the next, you know, most respectable thing to do since everybody in town was watching me, you know. And banks work Monday mornings. That wasn't working out for me at all. I am not a Monday morning kind of a girl. And so a friend of mine was going to Florida, and he said, let's go. And I thought, yes, let's. And so we took off to South Florida in 1978. Now, I heard when I was new that they should just put a sign on the state line of Florida, California, and Arizona that says, this state doesn't work either. And would save some of us a few years. But we went to South Florida to a little burg called Bonita Springs. At the time, it was three traffic lights and a dog track. You know, it was the whole town was 2 or 3 miles long. These were my people. I mean, that's when I was home, when I got down there. The whole town's 3 miles long, and everybody bought beer at the store on this end of town, drink on the way to the bar on this end of town. You know, those are my people. And I got a job at a convenience store there right away because I had worked at one in Ohio, and you know, I didn't know it, but it was so transient where I was that if you showed up for work 3 days in a row, you were management material. So by the time I called my parents and mentioned that I had moved to Florida, which I had neglected to tell them, I said, oh, but don't worry, I'm assistant manager at this store. And my mom said something she would say so many times, which was, how can you do something this stupid and land on your feet? It just made her crazy. And she is not alcoholic. And, you know, so I started off being assistant manager at the store, and it wasn't long before my drinking caught up with me. And I moved down there in April of 78, and by November, December of 78, I was seriously looking at having to move back to Ohio because I couldn't support I was already out of places to work down there, and romantic prospects were slim. I had, I'd pretty much slept my way through the town already, and you know, unless somebody moved in from out of town, I was in big trouble. And, you know, because that's another thing that alcoholism took away from me. You know, I try to bring this up. It's not a pretty part of my story, but I don't ever want a new girl to leave a meeting where I've been thinking she doesn't fit here either because she's too bad. You know, what alcoholism did for me and dating is I went from somebody's mom dropping us off at the movies pretty much to waking up hoping I know who this is, and there was very little in between. You know, there was very little in between. I had to learn how to date when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't have a clue. They said dating's no sex, Beth. It is? You know, I mean, my idea of dating is you wake up, if you remember him or if you like him, he can stay, and now you're a couple. And that's how I did it. And that's pretty much how I ended. You know, my first marriage was like a one night stand that just dragged on for 5 years. And neither one of us is going to admit we made a mistake, you know. And So when I got to AA and they talked about dating, it's coffee before the meeting or coffee after the meeting. And if he walks you to the door, you're not sure whether to kiss goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. So anyways, as luck would have it, a guy moved to town from California. He didn't see the sign on the border that said this state doesn't work either. And so we hooked up, and it truly was, you know, just a one-night stand that dragged on. And we were married 5 years. We had two kids, which are, you know, the kids are my proof that God can turn any chaos to good. You know, they're good kids. And we ended up moving to the Keys in the middle of that. Same kind of deal, you know, went to the Keys on 4th of July weekend, came home Tuesday, liked it, moved on Friday with a six-month-old baby and $400, you know. Called my mom Saturday, oh, by the way, we moved to the Keys, but don't worry, I'm assistant manager at this restaurant, you know. You just hear her pounding her head on the phone. And you know, that was a wonderful place. We were in an oceanfront resort in the Upper Keys, and I eventually got into being their night auditor. You know, I didn't really know what one did, but I applied for the job, and they hired me. I got to take the baby to work with me. And, you know, I didn't know what a night auditor did, but they doubled my pay. And there were this was a big resort. It had 7 bars and 3 restaurants and, you know, all that full marina fleet. And they gave me the keys to all 7 bars, you know. And part of my job was to go around and ring out all the bars, you know, and then do all the numbers crunching all night. And so I had a drink at the quarter deck, and then I had a drink at the tiki bar, and then I would have a drink here, and you know, and then the horizon, we would just lock the elevators and sit up there and drink for a while and do a few other outside issues while we were there. And I mean, you know, I look back and I think nobody could have run a business like that. Everybody who worked there drank like me. The security guards were all bikers. It was a wonderful place, just a wonderful place. And while I was there, I went to happy hour one day at 5. I was still there at 11 when I was supposed to clock in. They were not very happy with me, and they fired me. And already, I kind of suspected that I was not going to find another job just like that one anywhere. You know, that they probably would want me to work all night without drinking somewhere else. And so I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was sometime in 1983. I went to the Tuesday night Key Largo meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were very friendly. They were very nice. They were very old. They're 40, 45, you know, I just couldn't see myself doing that one day at a time for the rest of my life. And you know, it was a discussion meeting, and somebody said something, and somebody else said, oh, I can really relate to that. And Newhart was big on TV back then, you know, with his little group in his office, and I just thought, oh, my God, you know, I just don't think I can do this. But I did go see my ex-boss and tell him I knew I had a problem with alcohol and that I was going to AA. And, you know, I had always been like this guy in the cartoons that walks down the sidewalk, you know, and the safes and the pianos are crashing behind him. I mean, that's just always, I just always narrowly escaped the consequence. And, I mean, the only time I ever got suspended from school for drinking, imagine that, it snowed 2 feet that night, and there was no school the next day, so there's nothing on my record. You know, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that just happened to me. And so I went and told my boss I knew I had a problem and I was going to AA, and they gave me my job back, you know, one AA meeting, because they had put the weekend girl up to a full-time. She didn't want to work full-time. Everybody hated her, and so I got my job back. So I went to the Friday night meeting of Key Largo Alcoholics Anonymous and said, I got my job back, thanks, and that was pretty much it for me in Key Largo AA. You know, I did call my dad and tell him I'd been to a meeting, because I periodically, when I would go home to visit, I would go to a meeting with him, and because we like to show off our kids, you know, and when they would go around the room and introduce themselves, I would say, my name's Beth, I'm with him. And so I called him and told him I'd been to an AA meeting and said I was an alcoholic, because that was the first time I'd ever said that out loud. You know, when you grow up with parents in AA, you have to be very careful to never even wonder aloud if you're alcoholic, because, you know, the AA police just swoop in with a meeting schedule and it's over. So I never said the A word in the same sentence with my name. You would not hear me sitting in a bar wondering if I was alcoholic or not. And so anyway, I called Dad, told him I'd been to a meeting, and within a week I got a package from him, and it had a big book, and a 12 and 12, and a one day at a time, and a 24-hour a day book, and an each day a new beginning book, and the acceptance pamphlet, and some bookmarks. They weren't doing T-shirts back then, or I'm sure I would have got a T-shirt too, but you know, I don't know how long he'd been collecting it, but he took his chance when I said I'd been to a meeting, and I don't know. I didn't drink for 7 or 8 months down there, but like I said, we had some other outside issues going in the Keys, if you could believe that. And we had a small, some people talk about being in the import-export business. I think the statutes run on this. I can talk about it. But, you know, we weren't really in the import-export business. We were more of a distributorship. You know, just a small little, you know, part-time. It was a part-time job to me. It was expensive to live in the Keys. I wanted a couple extra $100 a week and didn't want to be spending my money on that stuff, you know. And I remember the PO looking at me, you know, when I said something about it just being like a part-time job. She just looked at me weird. But, you know, we did. We got a We got arrested for that. You know, they called it sale of cocaine. We called it a part-time job. And that was the first trouble I got in I thought I might not get out of. That was kind of scary. And I ended up with 2 years of probation, and by now I'd given birth to my second child, my daughter, and I knew I wanted out of my marriage. You know, I had known for a long time I wanted out, but I didn't want to be the one that left because I didn't want it to be my fault that it was over. You know, and so I just drank until he couldn't stand it anymore and threw me out. And on the outside, I was saying, well, you know, this isn't a cooling down period. If we leave, we're gone because you asked us to leave. And inside, I was like, woohoo, finally, you know, yes, I'm out of here. And my mom would not send me money to relocate in Florida, which really saddened me, so I found myself stuck back in Ohio. Now, I have to tell you, I always knew Ohio was my problem. I was born in Northern California. They moved to Ohio when I was 2. And when I was 6 years old, I remember looking at a map of the United States and just thinking, you could look at a map and know nothing's happening in Ohio, you know? That was my first resentment. And I mean, ever since I'd known there were other places that were warmer or where there was a beach or, you know, anywhere but here is where I wanted to be. And so I found myself back in Ohio in 1984 with these two, you know, with a three-month-old baby and a two-year-old. And I got a job and I got an apartment, but I'll tell you, within a year, I was under arrest for child endangerment and my kids were placed in the custody of my mother because I walked down the street to drink after they were in bed. You know, they were asleep. There was nothing to drink in the house, and I had to have a drink. I was 26 years old, and I walked down the corner to the corner bar, which was about four doors down. And my son woke up, and he couldn't find me. He was 3. He came outside, looked in for me, and he couldn't, you know, it was a step down out the front door, so he couldn't reach the door to get back in. And he stood on the porch and cried, and somebody heard him and called the police. And the police called me at the bar. I mean, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where I was. My car was parked right outside. And so I ended up charged with child endangerment, you know. And I went to treatment because they said, maybe you won't go to jail if you go to treatment, which sounded like a really good plan to me. I didn't want to go to jail. But I'll tell you, you know, alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And when I was in treatment, I was the one that they would come get to talk to other women who didn't want to leave their kids for 6 weeks. You know, how I ended up in an all-women's treatment center, I will never know. You know, that's the other thing, that when I got to AA and they said, hang out with the women, I just thought, you got to be kidding me. I mean, I didn't even drink with women, you know. Why would I if I didn't have to? I could drink a lot. I could keep up with the big boys. So, you know, women to me were they either, you know, they fell down, they threw up, they giggled, you know, they wore pink in public. And it would get messy trying to drink with girls, you know, because we would all like the same guy, or I'd be sleeping with your husband or something, you know, that would be gumming up the works. And so every now and then I would have one good friend, maybe one good girlfriend. We would drink together, but we always both had our own car. You know, we would meet at the bar, because if you're a bar drinker, you know that when true love strikes, you got to be ready to go. And if you have to take your friend home first, he might fall in love while you're gone. So, you know, but I mean, that was just like when Alcoholics Anonymous said hang out with the women, I just thought, you know, it is bad enough I'm an AA, but this, I mean, it was just like hearing the gates of hell slam shut. You know, I just thought, you have got to be kidding me. So then I go to this treatment center and didn't do my research. It's an all-woman treatment center. But I was the one the counselors would come get to talk to women who didn't want to leave their kids for 6 weeks. And I would tell them, you know, we can't be good moms if we're not sober. And it's better to miss them for 6 weeks now than for months or years later. And inside, I just kind of, you know, this double life was starting to build. Because the truth be told, I was relieved that my kids were gone. I mean, it was too hard. It was hard being a single mom. You know, with a baby and a two-year-old, and I lived in a second-floor apartment. And if you have to go get something to drink, you know, then which kid do you put in the cold car while you go back and get the other one? And do you leave them in the car while you go? If you're carrying kids in the store, you can't get anything to drink. You know, you have no hands. And all of this, because I had just moved up from South Florida, and children were disappearing out of cars in 1980, 81, 82, 83. I mean, I knew you couldn't leave them in the car. And I couldn't seem to get them to daycare on time. And I couldn't, it just was... You know, and I would have good intentions. You know, I never set out to be a bad mom, but I just, I just couldn't do it. You know, my children were not beaten by me, and well, they were abandoned by me, obviously, but really I abandoned them emotionally long before I left them alone to drink. And the message my kids got from me all the time was, I love you, go away. Yes, I love you, get away from me. You know, I love you, I don't want to play, I don't want to color, go clean your room, go play with your sister, I don't want to go to the zoo. Of course I love you, honey. You know, and my kids were invisible. They were invisible when they were sitting by me. They could be talking, and I would be so far into my own head trying to figure out what to do next that I wouldn't even hear them, you know. And what a horrible thing to do to a kid. So I had all that going on. So I'm relieved that they're gone. Because at my mother's house, they got a bath every night. That she read them a story every night. They got dinner on time, age-appropriate food. They were to daycare on time. You know, with clean clothes every day. They were in a good neighborhood. You know, I knew they were better off with her. But you can't tell people you're glad your kids are gone, you know. I mean, they might think you're a bad mom, and that certainly looks bad, you know. So I'm telling these girls, yeah, you know, we got to be good moms to be sober, blah, blah, blah. And inside I'm thinking, thank God they're gone, you know. Outside I would tell you, of course I want my children back. And the cunning, baffling part of alcoholism is, you know, it takes so long for things to get from here to here. And when I was in that treatment center, they took us to meetings, outside AA meetings, and there was a man talking the first meeting I went to, and he talked about having nothing to drink in his house and pacing the floor, you know, pacing the floor because he had nothing to drink. And I just thought, that's awful. I'm so sorry for you. You know, you should be here. It's good they have AA for people like you. And it didn't dawn on me that I was sitting there because I had done the same thing. My children were in bed. I had nothing to drink. And I walked down to the bar because I had to drink. And it just never occurred to me that we were the same. You know, I just didn't get it. My dad died while I was in treatment. That was a huge blow because I was going to come be Jim Kirby's daughter in Cincinnati AA. And I was the only child of divorced parents, so I got the insurance money. And, you know, what that let me do was drink the way I wanted to drink for the next 2.5 years. I didn't really have to. I bartended here and there because it doesn't matter how many zeros are in your checkbook. If you can drink free, you know, drink free. And so I bartended. But I pretty much drank the way I wanted to drink. And I would make periodic efforts at, you know, trying to. But I wouldn't show up to get my kids when I was supposed to. And, you know, they were back in my custody briefly and within a week we're back at my mom's, and that was fine with me. Again, I would tell you I wanted them back, but you know, I didn't. And I would, you know, by now it's, life is just getting gray, you know, it's just getting gray. And I'm thinking, you know, every now and then I would quit drinking, and because I kind of knew, but you know, by the 10th day without a drink, even just 1 or 2 days without a drink, and a lot of guilt can creep in, you know, a lot of guilt. And my head would be almost to the pillow, maybe I'd had a good day, and then the voices in my head would start, yeah, Beth, but you don't even want your own kids. What the hell's the matter with you? You know, run that one by your friends and see how they take it. And I just, there was just too much noise in my head. And if in the event that I would go 8 or 10 days without a drink, by then my friends were usually offering to get me a beer because I was a little edgy. And, you know, so it was just, I don't know, it was a long gray period. And after I got sober, I wondered, you know, why didn't I just get sober then? You know, I mean, it's not like I didn't know AA was around. Why would I have kept drinking? And then one day I heard a guy talk, and he said, you know, I knew I was going to be miserable without drinking. I knew I'd probably be miserable if I drank, but if I took a drink, I at least had a shot at having a good time, you know. And I thought, that's it, that's it. I at least had a shot at having a good time, because every now and then when I drank, the planets were all lined up right, and all was good with the world. And the rest of the time, I just chased that feeling, you know. If I had come earlier, if I'd stayed later, if I'd gone here instead of there, if I was with him instead of him. You know, I was always trying to get that feeling of just everything's okay right where it is, of wanting to be where I was. And I didn't have that very often, you know. So anyway, it was just a long gray period. And at the end of 1987, I just remember thinking one night, I can't do this anymore. By now I was in a friend's attic apartment because I couldn't even pay my $250 a month rent. And I had moved in August. It was November. I hadn't even unpacked. You know, there was just a path to the couch, the TV, and the bed. And I just thought, God, I just can't do this anymore. You know, you have got to help me. And I remembered the big book that my dad had sent me. I still had it, you know, all these years later. And I always tell new people, when you get a big book, get a hardcover book. Because, at least for me, if I'd had a paperback, I could have shredded it or thrown it out the window. I never would have missed it. But there's something about a hardcover book that just, you know, I don't know. I may need this someday, or it's a good coaster. Who knows? But, you know, I still had the book my dad sent. And I pulled it out, and I opened it up to page one, which I'd done many times, you know, because... I mean, they tell you the directions for living are in here, right? And I never really read all that Roman numeral stuff because I thought if they wanted you to read it, that would have been page one. And I mean, who reads that stuff, you know? And so, you know, I would go looking for the directions for living, and I'd open up to page one, and it would say, "War fever ran high," and I just thought, "Oh, I am so screwed." You know, I mean, where's the directions? But that night, I read Bill's story, and it made sense to me. You know, because what I know now is when they wrote that book, there weren't meetings everywhere. And Bill's story is what I'm doing now, one person telling what they were like, what happened, and what they're like today. You know, they put a speaker meeting in the front of the book so that people who didn't know what alcoholism was could read it and maybe identify and maybe keep reading. And that night, I identified with Bill Wilson. You know, it was the first time. I identified with how he felt. I identified with how he thought. I slept clutching the big book, you know. I woke up rested and peaceful for the first time in a really long time. You know, now I'd love to say I've been sober ever since then, you know, because I do believe that God removed the obsession to drink. However, there's a catch to all this stuff in that book. You know, there's lots of prayers in the book, but every prayer is followed with an action. Every prayer is followed with an action. And that was the missing link. I was always missing this one little piece of staying sober, and that was staying surrendered. I had surrendered a million times, but we have to stay surrendered to stay here and be happy. And that's the process the book outlines, you know? And that day I woke up, I felt peaceful, but I didn't go to a meeting. I didn't call anybody. I didn't pray again. I didn't do anything. And late in the afternoon, the voices in my head were saying, "Oh, you may as well drink. You know you're going to get it over with," you know. So I did. But strange things started to happen. I was drinking in the Dewdrop Inn in Norwood, Ohio, a lovely establishment. There's one in every town. And I walked in, and the bartender starts talking about getting sober. And this person over here is talking about going to the AA clubhouse. And, you know, I'm in the Dewdrop surrounded by people talking AA and sobriety. You know, it just, I didn't drink most of early 88 and then went on one last bender in June of 1988 because by now I'd been in Ohio for 4 years. And I thought everybody in Florida was probably sitting down there going, "God, I wish Beth would come back." And so I went down there for my homecoming parade. And nobody was real thrilled to see me. I forgot I'd kind of left under the cloud of this arrest. And, you know, and I went on Mom's credit card because, of course, I didn't have any money. And didn't mention to her that me or her credit card were going to Florida. We just went. And although I'm glad back then $3,000 was a huge limit on a card. Thank God. But anyways, I went down to the Keys and I ended up, you know, by the end of a week, I was tired. The credit card was tired. I'd gone back over to Bonita Springs to see some friends. And on June 26, 1988, I was in the Fort Myers airport. And I didn't even have a dollar. I didn't have enough to buy one drink. And if I had, who knows who would be sitting here now, you know, because I had to have that first, you know, when Bill talks about that fierce determination to win coming back after he had the first drink. But I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't bear the thought of being asked to leave the airport bar if I was just sitting in there looking like I wanted somebody to buy me a drink. You know, my pride wouldn't let me do that. And I thought about, you know, I mean, there's a lot of retired people down there. I thought about just grabbing some little old lady's purse. So I'd have some money, but I wanted those hangovers, you know, and I just knew I would pick on the little old lady that still did aerobics twice a week. She'd run me down and take her purse back, and I'd look bad, and I didn't want to be the headline in the local paper, you know, "Purse snatcher stopped by octogenarian." So I called my mom, and basically what she told me is that, "I'm not flying you home, I'm flying the children's mother home. And it's only because we're afraid we'll never see you again." You know? And I got on the plane and I was relieved, and she picked me up at the airport, and she dropped me off at the local detox center, and I was not amused. You know, but she pulled up and she said, "I have done everything I can do for you. I've done everything I can do. I can't do anymore. I'm done. Go in or don't, but it's up to you." And you know, that's the first time really that I was accountable for my own recovery, because my favorite game was always, let me make it your job to see that I get my work done. I did it to my teachers, I did it to my parents, I did it to coaches, I did it to, you know, when I first came around AA, you know, I'd get a sponsor, but they weren't calling me as often as I thought they should, and, you know, because they should be calling me to see if I went to meetings, right? And so I went into detox because I didn't have anywhere else to go, and that was June 26, 1988, and I've been sober ever since, you know. Now, I had no idea that I was going to stay sober. I mean, I just went into sleep, and the next morning I'm laying there reviewing my options, and you know, a few things occurred to me. One was that I never expected to live to be 30. I just never, you know, I had a near fatal car wreck at 16. I drove drunk a lot. I had 3 DUIs in 14 years, which is, you know, not near what it should have been. I rode motorcycles when I couldn't walk. I had my own. I bartended in places where people shot at each other. You know, I hung out with motorcycle clubs. I mean, I should have been dead. I mixed drugs and alcohol. You name it, I did it. And it occurred to me that morning that I was 29 and a half and distressingly healthy. You know, one of the reasons I never attempted suicide, and I think somebody else said the same thing, I knew I would live. I knew I would live and end up, you know, just maimed and looking bad. And so that day, laying there in detox, I realized that I probably wasn't going to die. That I was probably going to die. If I was going to die young, I would have been dead already. And that I was probably going to live another 40 or 50 years, whether I drank or not. And the thought of another 40 years going the way I'd been going scared me to death. You know, it scared me to death. Because I knew at that moment, it didn't matter how bad it was, there were depths of worse that I hadn't even dreamed up yet. There are a lot of 70-year-old winos out there. And, I mean, I was a wino at 25. You know, I loved Wild Irish Rose. It was cheap. It got the job done. The bottle's square. It doesn't roll out from under the car seat. You got to think things like that through. And so then I started reviewing my options. And, I could work here. No, you can't. I could stay here. No, no, they're not talking to you. You know, and I just... My car was impounded. I didn't really have a place to live. I had charges pending. I didn't know what they were, but I was pretty sure they had something to do with the car being impounded. And, you know, that stuff wasn't really new. I had been there, done that. But what was different this time was I had no plan B. You know, my sponsor calls it having no friendly direction to turn. I just absolutely didn't have one better idea on what to do next. I realized at that moment that everything I had ever tried had failed miserably. And I just had this passing thought that, like, well, you know, whatever those AA people were doing seems to be working for them, and your way's not working for you. Maybe you ought to do what they're doing. And, I mean, now you couldn't have told me that was going to be the surrender that kept me sober. You know, it was pathetic. I mean, I don't go out in a blaze of glory. You know, my surrenders are usually of the two-word variety that I can't say from the podium, but word number two is it. You know, I mean, I'm just like... So I, that, you know, unbeknownst to me, turned myself into AA that day, and I got out of detox on Friday of 4th of July weekend, so I couldn't get my car till Tuesday. I suspected if I went where I lived, I would drink, so I found a hotel room, a cheap hotel that was on the bus line, and I just had to take one bus down to the AA clubhouse, and that's what I did. You know, I went that night, and the woman who was speaking that night was 4 years sober, and I had met her 4 years ago when I had passed through AA. And the thing she said from the podium that just blew me away was she said that alcoholism took her to the place where she didn't want to work and she didn't want to take care of her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And I couldn't believe anybody would say that out loud, because that was my biggest secret. That was my biggest secret. And here she was saying that was alcoholism too. And she became my first sponsor, you know. And I didn't set out to do a 90 and 90, because I'm the kind, you know, I'm a numbers person anyway. And the way my brain works, by the time I did 3 meetings, I'd be going, okay, 87 to go, you know. So I just knew that when I got up today, I was going to try to go to a meeting. you know, and I just, you know, I would go to a meeting today. And the second night I went, you know, because it was, I got out on Friday, I went back Saturday night, and I didn't want to, you know, I still didn't really want to be new. I mean, I love Vince Y from California says, if you're new, we already know a lot about you. You know, for starters, we know it hasn't been a good year. And so I kind of sensed at this clubhouse, you know, that if you sit in the back, we know you're new. And if you sit in the front, you have to talk to people. So I wanted to kind of be, you know, look like I knew what I was doing. So I sat in the second row, and that I call the new guy chair now because I wasn't the only one that sat there. But it was, you know, it was against the wall, and it was in the second row. And I did stand up and say I was new, which was new for me. You know, I did. I just thought, I'm just doing it all because, you know, not doing it all never worked. And so I stood up and said I was new. And this night I'm, you know, I'm sitting on the end where I only maybe have to talk to one person. And when it was time to say the Lord's Prayer, of course, there's a wall over here. I have no hand to hold. What a loser am I? You know, I can't even say the Lord's Prayer right. And I just hung my head and hooked my thumb in my pocket and just thought, you know, I mean, the middle of an AA meeting can be a really lonely place when you're new. You know, the one thing crowds did for me is when I walked into a room, a crowd like this would separate into two groups, you know, except it wouldn't separate like this. It would be all of you and me. And I just hung my head and started to say the Lord's Prayer, and somebody in front of me grabbed my hand. And I can't tell you the relief I got from that. I mean, I just started to cry. I had no idea, you know, that somebody would take the time to look behind them and be sure everybody was holding hands. And so I'm crying, and then by the time we're halfway through the prayer, now I'm trying to stop crying, you know, so I'll look cool when I'm done. But I'll tell you, I have never to this day found out who that person was, but they're the reason I came back on Sunday. You know, 12-step work is not just sponsoring a bunch of people. 12-step work is not just taking meetings to institutions. What that person did that day was 12-step work. You know, they were carrying the message of AA to me. And stuff like that is so important, you know. Remembering a new person's name is 12-step work. God, I just wanted you to know who I was. And I didn't even know that's what I wanted. I couldn't have told you that's what I wanted. You know, I was a tough broad. I don't need you people, but I desperately, desperately wanted you to know who I was. And, you know, I mean, we live in these paradoxes. It's no wonder we can't live comfortably, you know, because we're on opposite sides in our head, let alone being at odds with the rest of the world. I mean, my biggest one that is, you know, is that, okay, most alcoholics suffer from a fear of being alone, but we don't really like people, you know. It's hard to live comfortably in conflict like that. And so I just started to show up on a regular basis. They had noon big book meetings at this place. They had a big book meeting every day at noon, and I started to go there for lots of good reasons, none of which had to do with staying sober or learning about the book. I went because they went around the room and read a whole chapter every day. And I knew from all my years in and out of AA that you should read your big book every day. I figured this would count. I wouldn't have to read at home. Plus, when they read the whole chapter, it chewed up half of the hour, so chances were much better I would not get called on to talk. And I had my whole day free after 1 o'clock, and I'd still kept my commitment to go to a meeting. But, you know, I've learned that God has a sense of humor. And while that's why I went, here's what happened. When you read the book, I started to hear it, you know, because my brain was mush when I was new. It was mush. And when I would try to read the book, I would either realize that I had just read the same paragraph 14 times or that I was 12 pages from where I started and had no idea what I'd read, you know, or I'd really try hard and just concentrate on one paragraph and I would close the book and it would be gone. I'd have, you know, it just would be gone. And when you guys read it, I could hear it somewhat, you know, but I still couldn't stay on the page much. I mean, it was, you know... Here's my big book experience. New, they're reading along and they're saying, boy, I don't have my contacts in. Maybe I'll be reading. So, you know, easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take. I wonder what it's going to cost to get my car out of impound, you know. I wonder what time and pretty soon I'd hear the page turn, you know, so I'd be back on the page, you know, chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him. I wonder if that guy's got a girlfriend. He's kind of, you know, I mean... I couldn't stay on the page, but it started to seep in a little, you know, and here's how I know it started to seep in. I've told you, you know, all these people are up here in my head. They're still there. I just don't check in very often, But, you know, I would leave a meeting and go to run an errand or something, and I'd pop in up here to see what we were all talking about. And the voices in my head were saying, well, that was pretty cool what Guy said today. Yeah, I didn't know that was in the book. And I thought, dear God, even the people in my head are getting sober, you know? Somebody told me just to point a sober chairperson and get the hell out of there. So it did start to creep in. I could hear your voice when I couldn't hear mine. And the biggest joke on me, well, I also, you know, I had my whole day free after 1, but about 5:30 I had to remember I had no life. And so I go back for another meeting. So I did 2 meetings a day a lot. And the last thing I didn't know was that people who go to big book meetings on purpose tend to read the book and do what it says. So out of sheer laziness, I had plopped down into the middle of the most active people in Cincinnati Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And what attracted me to that meeting was there was laughter there. You know, people were reading the book and relating it to their lives now, not just relating it to their drinking. And they would tell on themselves about the goofy stuff they did last week, you know. There was a gaiety there and a laughter and a seriousness about Alcoholics Anonymous that when I had come around before, I had been to a few discussion meetings that were ever so serious, and the book says we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And the book says we insist on enjoying life, you know. And the book says we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. And, you know, personally, that appeals to me. I'm always so sad when a newcomer comes in and gets happy and some well-meaning person runs over to say, well, you better watch out because you're going to fall off that pink cloud, you know. I just tell the new people, ask them to show you where that is in the book. You know, because my book says we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. It doesn't say a word. You know, what I want to say to those people who tell new people, watch out, you know, is are you still doing now what you did when you were new? Because maybe if you were still doing it, you would still be happy. But just my opinion. Anyways, they did tell me when I was new, they said, you're going to hear a lot in AA, and a lot of what you hear isn't going to be AA. And if you hear something that confuses you, ask them to show it to you in the book, because you can trust the book. And this has been the foundation I've stood on ever since I got sober. I wasn't sober very long, 2 or 3 weeks, and somebody said, Beth, you've been around before, why don't you write an inventory? And I thought, okay. I mean, I didn't know I could say I wasn't ready. So I wrote an inventory, and this woman that became my sponsor heard my fist step, you know, and we got into making amends, and I mean, I have never looked back. You know, I was making amends by the time I was a month sober. Thank God. Thank God, you know, because the book says if you decided you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths, you're ready to take certain steps. It doesn't say anything about after you're 6 months sober. And I couldn't have gone 6 months without drinking, I don't think, you know. And so... So I got into action, and I'm in the middle of this active group, and things just started to happen, you know. I started to spend some time with my kids. One of the things that really changed my life happened when I was a week out of detox. I went to that Friday night meeting again, and they passed the basket because a member of that group's 9-year-old daughter had been killed by a drunk driver that day. And, you know, the next Tuesday, he was at that big book meeting, and I couldn't believe he was there, you know, after his daughter had been killed. And he talked at the meeting, he shared, and he said that, you know, it happened in Cincinnati. If you got a DUI, you had to go to a place called Drake Hospital for your 3-day court-ordered weekend. And this happened right outside of Drake Hospital while the DUI people were on break outside smoking. And he said maybe if one of them saw that and got sober, then she didn't die for nothing. You know, he said, I just have to believe that something will come out of this. And when I left that day, I was kind of mulling that over, and I remember I was walking across the street to my car, and I just remember thinking, what if my kids had been in that car? You know, what would their last thought of me have been? Or what if I had been in that car? What kind of memories would they be left with? Because I'll tell you, my word was worth nothing to those kids. My word was worth nothing to anybody. You know, I had no integrity. I had no honor. I had no dignity. And I had this passing thought that I could go right then to a phone and call my kids and tell them that I loved them, you know, just because, not with any other motive, just tell them I loved them and that I had a chance to build a relationship with them. I had this reprieve, this second chance, this gift. And, you know, when the gift thing went by up here, I just thought, where did that come from? Because gift is not a word I ever associated with being sober. You know, I mean, you know, when you're in detox, it's always the happy, sober people that come to the detox meetings, and all you see is teeth, you know. And I mean, grateful people mostly made me want to puke. And, you know, but that day I just realized I had a chance, and that I might never be a regular mom again. I might be a weekend mom until they were grown. But if I was, I could be a good weekend mom, and I could come when I was supposed to, and I could keep my word to them. And you know, I know now that's the first time I took life on life's terms, that I just took the hand I'd been dealt instead of saying, if it was different, things would be better, if I had them, if, you know. I just started where I was. And I started to build a relationship with my kids, and I started to make amends to my kids, and the first amend I made to my children was that I stopped making promises I couldn't keep. You know, I was very careful what I promised them, and I would fulfill a promise before I make another one. And we started to build a relationship. And they came to meetings with me on the weekend, not because I wanted to include them in my recovery, but because I knew I'd kill them if I went 3 days without a meeting. And, you know, an odd thing happened to my children. As they started to hang out with you, their eyes started to come up off the floor. They started to look the world in the eye, you know. I'll tell you, the two most precious promises to me in this book is we can look the world in the eye and we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Because those were things that were just beyond my grasp my whole life. And I didn't know how to talk to my kids. I mean, I don't know how to talk to anybody. I'm not an intuitive mother, you know. But I watched you guys talk to my kids. And I saw you guys greet them by name. And I saw you guys, when you talked to them, you would sit down and talk to them on eye level. And you would color with them. And you would ask them to help you go get the coffee cups. And if they came up and talked to you, you stopped what you were doing and sat down and looked at them while you talked to them. And I started to learn how to talk to my children. And my children started to look the world in the eye. And they loved AA. And things, you know, things just started to happen. I got, by the time I was, I don't know, somewhere under a year sober, I had a car, a driver's license, and insurance all at the same time. That was huge. And when I was around a year sober, we went to a picnic, you know, an eating meeting with a speaker. And we did that stuff a lot, and when we got there, I told my kids, you know, there's kids over there playing. If you want to go play, that's fine. I always told them that. They never went and played. It was no big deal. You know, we hung out on the weekends. And that day, about half an hour later, I felt a tug on my leg, and here's my son, who's now 7, and he said, Mom, I just wanted to let you know that we're over here if you need us. And I realized, you know, the amazing thing is that every now and then, it's like God picks up the curtain, and I get a glimpse of what the bigger deal is, you know? And the miracle is that I'm paying attention when he does that. You know, and what I realized at that moment was my kids knew if they let me out of their sight, I would be there when they got back. And that took a year, you know? And thank God I didn't make them go play, that I just let them hang out with me. And so we kept showing up. And, you know, by the time Thanksgiving of 89 rolled around, I'm, you know, coming up on a year and a half sober. Got the car, little apartment, little job, you know. So I start thinking, you know, Robbie's 7 now, 7 and a half really, and he's got all these women in his life. I mean, Mom and Sarah, his sister and me, and he really, you know, a 7-year-old little guy ought to have some male input in his life. And for his sake, I should start looking for, you know, a relationship. Now, don't laugh. That's the kind of loving, giving mom I am, you know. So 405 Oak Street, the clubhouse, did a big Thanksgiving spread every year at 1 o'clock, and we went early, and I went to the noon Big Book meeting, because that's what I do if there's a Big Book meeting around. And when I came out, I couldn't find my son, and somebody said, go look across the street. There was a schoolyard across the street, and here was my 7-year-old son and another 7-year-old boy and 4 of the guys in, you know, from Oak Street that were 20, 21, 22, over there playing football. And again, the curtain lifted for a second, and I thought, where else should a 7-year-old boy be on Thanksgiving? Except playing football with a bunch of guys, you know. But the real miracle of that moment is that I realized I had absolutely nothing to do with making that happen other than the fact that I went to the meeting, you know, that when I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, the needs of my children get met too. And I took that to heart, you know, and temporarily I called off the manhunt. And I just kept doing AA, you know. It's like, I mean, my whole experience in AA has been that, you know, when I got here, I had nothing. My scale was empty, you know. And I went to a few meetings, and I became employable. And I went to a few more meetings, and I got my license. And more meetings, and I got my, you know, work the steps. And it's I just think this side is my business over here, you know. I put what I have into Alcoholics Anonymous, and God fills up this side. And the problems I see people run into is that, you know, we start getting things over here and we want to help God with them, you know. And it's like, thanks for the job, God. Now I'm going to work 80 hours a week and miss meetings. And this side starts to get light, you know. My job is to put it into AA. I heard a guy say once he thought God gave us AA to just keep us busy and out of his way, you know, so he could run our lives. And that's really been my experience, you know. I did end up, Chuck and I started to date when I was about 2.5 years sober. We had met when he was, I've got 6 months on him, so which I remind him of pretty regular. Right now we're both 16, so I'll have to wait till June before I can help him again. But anyway, he came to give a talk, and because he had gotten sober out in the area meetings, and he spoke at Oak Street when he was a year sober. And I remember thinking, oh, how sober can this guy be? I don't even know him, you know, because, I mean, I knew everybody at Oak Street. And he gave such a great talk, I just thought, you know, I want what this guy has, and I am willing to go to any lengths to get it. I didn't tell him that, but... Now, actually, we crossed paths a few times over the next year, but we didn't start to date until about a year later. And we dated. I mean, we dated. We did coffee before the meeting, coffee after the meeting. We didn't both totally shift our AA schedule to be together every waking moment. You know, I mean, I was telling somebody the other day, our first date was after a Friday night meeting, and on Friday nights I picked people up at the treatment center and took them back. So, you know, we saw each other at the meeting, and then he went on up and bought the tickets, and I took people back to the treatment center and met them at the movie. You know, that's how we dated. But that worked for us because we kept AA first. You know, we made a decision early on to keep AA first, well, God first, and then AA, and then each other. You know, that if I am first in his life, things are out of balance because we got what we have by putting God first. And so we set about getting to know each other, and he asked me to marry him, and we were married a year later, and we still wanted to get married, which was a good sign, you know. We hadn't broken up and gotten back together 14 times that year, and we were married in July of 1992, so we celebrated 12 years of marriage last July, you know, what a great thing to have a life companion in AA. You know, he's got a sponsor, he's got a home group, he sponsors guys. You know, we have stayed active side by side, and that's such a joy. You know, it's such a joy. I mean, we've been married that long, and I still like him. You know, I mean, I know a lot of people in love, but they don't look excited when he walks into the room. And I just tell people, you know, my rule of thumb is the room a nicer place when he walks in? You know, and I spoke to him this morning. He sends his love, and because I'm with you, and he also let me know. Sometimes I forget little details, like we did get custody of the children back. When I was a year sober, my mom and I talked, and we decided that no greater good in the name of family unity would be served for me to take custody of the children. They had been at her house, by the time I was a year sober, they had been with her for 4 years. They were in a wonderful school district, a safe, clean neighborhood. They had continuity in their lives. They had friends. You know, they had been doing what they were supposed to do. I was living in an efficiency apartment, you know, where I could see the AA clubhouse out my window in a crummy section of town, and I knew I was going to be moving 3 or 4 times before I settled. And, you know, what good is served by totally disrupting their lives just so I can have them back? And so we talked to the kids, and my job was to catch up to them. You know, they had been doing what they were supposed to do. I'm the one that was all over the map. And so they stayed with my mom, and you know, Chuck and I got married, and we moved to the... we caught up to the suburb right next to them, and Sarah ended up coming to live with us a year before Robbie did, and then that summer we found a house in the neighborhood where they had been, and we moved in, and my kids started 5th and 7th grade walking out the door of Mom and Dad's house, you know, and getting on the bus like all the other kids, and you know, the day we signed the custody papers back, we took candy to our home group, pink and blue. It's a boy, it's a girl, you know. And because we'd only been married a year, and people said, are you having kids? And we said, yeah, they're 9 and 11. Isn't it cool? And that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I mean, when I was new, I didn't know if I'd get my kids back or not. And my sponsor would say, it's in the book. And I was looking for, you know, if you're a single mother and blah, blah, blah. And kids over. I was about 6 years sober, and I noticed this line that said, families will be reunited. Oh, you know, but we've had such a journey, you know, we kept, you know, we got the kids back, unfortunately cute blonde kids turned into blonde teenagers, and it turned out my son was the kindred spirit with us, and we had some really rocky years, high school age years. There were some bad times, you know, but we kept AA first, you know, AA and God first, and we just did, you know, put one foot in front of the other, and we got through it. And there was a time I wouldn't have told you if we would ever all sit in the same room again. You know, but we're great friends now. And like I said, my daughter's at Fort Hood, Texas now. 4 years after she joined the, or 4 years, 4 months after she joined the Army, my son looked around and said, I do better in structure. And he joined the Army. And he is actually in Baghdad right now. And, you know, when my husband called this morning, he told me that we got an email from Robbie yesterday. So, you know, as of today, he's alive and well and doing his job in Baghdad. They're both active duty, you know, U.S. Army, and we're just so proud of him. You know, he got to be there for that election last week, and you know, how amazing would it be to be in the middle of history like that? Although we are in the middle of history here, you know? I mean, that's the amazing thing about this. When I was new, I heard a guy named Ernie the Attorney speak, and he's sober, what, about 100 years now, Jack? I mean, he's sober a really long time. And what he said was that when history looks back on a pioneering movement, the first 100 years is what they consider the pioneering time. And we're in the first 100 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we will be looked back at as part of the pioneering time. And God help us sometimes, you know, but I mean, that's so amazing, you know, so amazing to watch it grow and change. And, you know, just since I've been sober, AA has gone into Russia, you know, when everything happened over there, before that was illegal assembly, and you know, just in my span of sobriety, Alcoholics Anonymous is in what used to be the communist bloc. And when I went to the World Conference in Seattle in 1990, Russia was there with their flag, and everybody went crazy. It's just an exciting time to be sober. I have a couple more kid stories, and then I'll let you go. I can't believe there's so many of you here on Sunday morning. Not the 5,000 Jack had last night, but there's pretty many people here. And, you know, I said my daughter lived next door, and we were in the suburb next, so we kept her in the same school, and I would drive her to school every day. And I'm not an intuitive mother, you know, so I would pull up, and, you know, this is so suburban where they lived, and so it was all of them and me, you know, and I would pull up. Everybody had a minivan. Everybody had a minivan but me, and I would pull up behind them, and, you know, that kid would get out, Sarah would get out, and I'd go to leave, and this minivan's still there. So I'd have to pull out and go around. So this went on for a while, and I started thinking, I wonder what they do. I bet they all go have coffee. I bet they don't have to work. Blah, you know. Blah. So I decided I was going to hang out tomorrow and see what they do. You know, I'm just going to watch. So I pulled up behind the minivan. That kid got out. Sarah got out. That mother watched until her child was safely in the building, and then she left. Now, it never occurred to me Sarah wouldn't get safely into the building. It was 100 feet to the door, and the principal was on the sidewalk. But I remember thinking, huh, that must be what mothers do. So the next day, I pulled up, and that kid got out, and Sarah got out. And that mom watched till her kid got in the building, and she left. And I watched till Sarah got in the building, and I left. And I just cried all the way to work. You know, I'm doing a mom thing. I can't believe it, you know. And I just never, you know, that's how I've learned to do everything here. I learned how to be sober watching sober people. You know, I learned how to be married watching successful marriages. And I've learned how to parent my children watching people who know how to talk to kids. And what a joy it's been. I never would have told you that I wanted to be here. You know, I never would have told you I wanted to be here. I'd spent my whole life wishing I was somewhere else. And when we were up, we'd, you know, caught up to the suburb next, and we bought bicycles for the kids one Christmas, and we got bikes for ourselves too because they were pretty little. We thought we better ride with them. So the first nice warm spring day, you know, the kids are over for the weekend, and we get on our bikes, and we're out, you know, mom, dad, big brother, little sister, riding through the suburbs on our bikes, you know. And I didn't really think about how it was all looking, but we're, you know, we're going down the street, and guy's out mowing his grass. I remember thinking, okay, mow the grass. That must be what some, you know, that's what they do out there. They mow the grass. And he waves, so we wave back because that's what they do in the suburbs. Everybody waves, you know. And about the time I waved, that old Zoom camera of mine came back for a second, and I got a look at where I was. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, I used to own a Harley Davidson, and I'm riding through the suburbs on a lavender Huffy. Now, you could not have told me when I was new, guess where you're going to be in 5 years, Beth, you know? But the most amazing part of that was right there at that moment, there's nowhere else I wanted to be but on that bike with those kids. I wanted to be where I was. And that's been the biggest gift I've gotten here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know that was the result of building a relationship with God. I didn't know that was a result of being one of many. You know, I don't want to be one of many. You know, just I'll be the best or the worst. Don't ask me to be average, you know. But being one of many has been the very thing that's given me a sense of purpose. You know, I have a sense of purpose here. I have a sense of belonging. And most days I want to be where I am. And what a miracle that is, you know. What a gift to want to be where I am and to want what I have, you know, and to have it to share with others. And that's why we come out weekends, you know, instead of hanging out home and watching football and stuff. I mean, there's no great glory in speaking like this, but, you know, we owe it to those who are looking to let them know that, you know, I mean, what this 12 step says is we carry this message to Alcoholics Anonymous, to alcoholics, and practice these principles in all our affairs. And I have to be careful that, you know, what this message is, you know, because it's not my message. You know, this message is that I was beyond human aid and that no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, even my sponsor. And that God could and would if he was sought. And that's my experience, and that's what I wish for all of you. Thank you.